Welcome to The Nature of Florida, the Sunshine State's only podcast dedicated to its wild and natural places and the fight to preserve them. I'm your host, Oscar Corral, a two-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and journalist. I've dedicated much of my career to making films about environmental issues. Tune in each week to hear from a broad range of voices, from scientists to surfers, activists to mermaids, who are working on the front lines to save what's left of Florida's natural beauty and its wildlife. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Nature of Florida podcast. My guest today is a lawyer and activist who has dedicated a good part of her life in the past few years to advocating against harmful practices from phosphate mining in Florida. That's a huge topic right now, as many of you listeners may have heard of the disaster that unfolded in early 2021 at the Piney Point Chip Stack, where millions of gallons of polluted water were released in an emergency into Tampa Bay to avert a collapse of the dam that holds back hundreds of millions of gallons near the bay. Rachel is an expert on the environmental problems associated with mining for phosphate, and I'm glad she's with us today. Rachel, welcome to the Nature of Florida podcast.
Thanks, Oscar. Thank you for having me.
So, Rachel, tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you from Florida originally? What led you to study law here?
Yes, I was born and raised in Florida, and I've always had an interest in the environment, loved being outdoors. I actually grew up in South Florida. Believe it or not, I grew up in one of those sort of cookie cutter homes built on top of the Everglades and couldn't wait to get out of there. And I found my way on the West Coast in West Central Florida, which is also ground zero for phosphate mining in this country and the world. And so that's how I got involved in the issue. And even though I'm a lifelong Floridian, I had no idea that the world's largest phosphate mine was in Florida until I became an attorney and started working on the issue a few years ago.
How did you come across that topic early on? What opened your eyes to it?
I actually was on my way to a hearing in Apalachicola on the Florida Black Bear Hunt when I first started working in the environmental law field. And we were in a Cessna to get there, and we passed over these, you know, large tracts of it looked like a moonscape. There's no real way to describe it. And it didn't look like something that was on Earth. It looked like another planet. And I asked, you know, my colleagues in the plane, what is that? And they're like, oh, those are phosphate mines. And that was my first introduction to that sort of, you know, devastating, large scale landscape size destruction that you don't typically see unless you get a sort of bird's eye view from above.
Tell me about that first glimpse of a phosphate mine from above. What did you see? Describe it to me. You describe a moonscape. Elaborate.
Yeah,
a little bit.
So there's this unnatural rutting, these sort of greenish neon green ponds of water that are filled with all of these sort of redistributed elements that are brought to the surface that don't naturally belong there. And this was, it didn't even look like an active mine. It looked like a mine that was waiting to be reclaimed, which is a whole another issue that we can get into. But yeah, it just didn't look right. And it was as far as the eye could see. And once I found out that there was almost 500,000 acres of land that have had that sort of violent transformation in Florida, I was alarmed, to say the least.
So you're saying there's 500,000 acres in Florida that have been phosphate mined? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, about 475,000. Wow. Yeah, that's roughly the size of about half the size of the state of Rhode Island. And that's right in the middle of Florida, the part of Florida that, you know, doesn't get much attention, that Florida heartland. But yeah, that's, you know, it's never going back to the way it was.
So walk me through that first reaction. You were flying over these phosphate mines in a Cessna, and you saw this moonscape that you described below. That's when you were younger, you saw that. What were the next steps you took after that?
You know, my boss at the time was already familiar with the issue, and we talked, and she put me in touch with some of the some of my colleagues that I'm now working for now. But yeah, she also expressed the same sort of shock that we could be native Floridians and we could be environmental activists and yet still not know for most of our lives that this was happening. And that just, I think, speaks to the sort of skill and the sort of PR machine that the industry is so adept at. I've never seen such an environmentally destructive industry be able to shift that narrative into one that makes them seem like they're environmentalists quite as well as the phosphate industry in Florida has done. And it really has, you know, dampened awareness. So hopefully, you know, I've been a part and a small part in raising that awareness at minimum, but that this is happening.
Rachel, describe in a little bit more detail what phosphate mining entails in Florida.
Sure. Well, I'll start by backing up and just for your listeners that don't know, phosphate is mined for phosphate fertilizer production. So much of the country's fertilizer is produced in Florida, and certainly mined. The phosphate that's used to produce that fertilizer is mined mostly in Florida. It's also a lot of that ore is shipped to Louisiana across the Gulf and further processed into fertilizer. So that's what phosphate is mined for. And typically, if you're just an owner of a few thousand acres, you're not going to mine for fertilizer in that way. It's usually a much larger scale operation than that. There's, you know, mines are typically around 15 to 20,000 acres at any given time. And these are large corporations that do that at this time. So there used to be about 30 in the state. That industry is volatile. There's, you know, the market's volatile, fertilizer market's volatile, it's razor thin margins. There's a lot of, you know, environmental risk involved. So many of these companies have gone bankrupt. And so as that industry has sort of consolidated into through a series of mergers and bankruptcies, there's really only about five major fertilizer companies left in the country. Two in Florida, with a third trying to start, as you know, in Bradford and Union County. What these companies do is they first start out by removing what they call overburden, which is a euphemism for wildlife and plants. And they do that through burning, typically using some flamethrowers or by other means to get rid of all the vegetation and wildlife. And then they'll take what's like a million pound drag line that it's one of the largest earth moving pieces of equipment on earth. And they'll use that to strip mine. So they'll dig these deep trenches about 60 feet deep.
So let me just interrupt you there. You mentioned this word overburden, and mm-hmm. you said it's a euphemism. So that's a euphemism for everything that people love out there. Right. Overburden is the forests, the rivers, the wetlands, the right. flowers, the native grasses, the wildlife, the alligators, the turtles. That's what the industry calls overburden, right?
Right. Wow. And that's low. Right. And also every piece of soil that's above the ore itself.
So not only what's at the top, not only the top layer, which is what's visible to people, but also, you know, several feet below that. So, you know, you're not right. just talking about the plants and the roots. It's the soil that's underneath that maybe has been there for thousands or right. millions of years.
The native hydrology, all of that soil.
So
all that's redistributed.
So these corporations labeled all the beauty that we love as overburden. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So everybody, if you're ever walking through a beautiful forest, there's a corporation out there that considers that overburden that needs to be removed. All right. Correct. Sorry. Go ahead, Rachel. Continue.
Yeah. Yes, you're correct. So it's about 60 feet deep, could vary, give or take another 20 feet, but they'll dig down to the phosphate matrix, which is about one third phosphate, one third sand, and one third clay. Once they do that, they'll use copious amounts of water to blast that matrix to separate the ore from the clay and the sand tailings. And through a process called beneficiation, which uses a slate of flotation reagents. Many of those are proprietary. And again, very large amounts of water. Once that ore is separated from the clay and the sand is set aside to sort of recontour all those mine cuts later on in the reclamation process. But the clay ends up in what's called a clay settling area, which ends up constituting about 40% of the post-mining landscape. And it's very notoriously difficult to reclaim that that sort of area, that those clay sediment areas are radioactive. They're swollen with those flotation reagents, and they are permanently above grade in these large mounds where that clay is supposed to settle out over a period of decades.
Wow. So they leave behind these mountains of these hills of clay. Waste clay that is partially radioactive, hard to grow anything on it. So basically they destroy landscape and in many cases leave behind waste that is almost impossible to renovate with new forests or, you know, anything.
Right.
Anything.
And those clay settling areas, while they're settling out, they have breached. There's been two massive clay settling. I say clay settling, and that's really, again, a way that the industry has sort of infected affected us with euphemisms. They used to be called clay slime areas, right? Because that's what it is. It's toxic slime. And those clay slime areas, which I should remind myself to return to when I talk about them, those have breached, and there's been causing devastation along the entire length of the Peace River, all the way to Port Charlotte in the 60s and 70s. There's no reason that couldn't happen again as mining expands, and it is expanding. So and that's, again, just one part of a four-step process of destruction that starts with the mine, continues on to the beneficiation process, and then moves from the processing of that ore into phosphogypsum and fertilizer. And then, of course, we have the fourth step, which is actual fertilizer use and all the runoff and harmful algal blooms that we're seeing as a result of that.
Does this fertilizer get sold in stores like Home Depot, or is it mostly for commercial uses on farms and agriculture?
It's mostly for commercial uses on farms and the most fertilizer that's produced just gets used in sort of monocropping out west for grain production, actually. And that's not even for human consumption, right? That's not so. Mosaic, which is the world's largest phosphate mining company, their slogan is, "We help the world grow the food it needs," or "We feed the world," something to that effect. I'm forgetting the exact terms, but it's really helping the world grow the grain it needs to feed cattle, which then in turn, I suppose, feeds a portion of the world. But that's a very resource intensive way, very climate change inducing way to grow food. And it's a very toxic way even to generate that fertilizer needed to do that. So a lot of that it's commercial for commercial purposes. Some of it is then incorporated into, you know, fertilizer that you can buy at the store. But these, you know, this idea that the local consumer can, you know, sort of stop this by not fertilizing their lawn, it's a bit of a myth. It's going to take more than that. It's going to take a broad sort of transformation of our food system.
I want to touch upon a couple of the environmental disasters that have occurred even recently due to phosphate mining and to the waste stacks that they leave behind. So tell me about these gyp stacks. You mentioned these slime mounds. Talk to me about the gyp stacks. What is that? Sure. Where are they? And what are they made up of?
Right. So a clay slime area is that second part of the process after that beneficiation. We get a gyp stack when we're actually processing the mineral itself. So when that phosphate ore is beneficiated, separated, that gets transported to a fertilizer plant where the actual fertilizer is produced from that ore. And that chemical reaction involves large amounts of sulfuric acid being added to that phosphate ore, that phosphate rock, that then produces phosphoric acid, which is a key fertilizer ingredient, and phosphogypsum and process water in a slurry at a rate of 5 tons of phosphogypsum for every 1 ton of phosphoric acid. So
Whoa.
The product, that first, you know, product that is that the fertilizer industry is after, the chemical reaction is really creating 5 tons more waste than it is that product.
So how do they dispose of these wastes? For every ton of product, they create 5 tons of waste. What do they do with it?
So because it's radioactive, it has
radioactive waste. Okay.
Yes. So radium-226 is the radionuclide that's of most concern, and it's present naturally in the ore, but the process, that chemical reaction, concentrates that radiation and transfers it into most of it into the waste. So it moves from the ore into the phosphogypsum, creating a radioactive waste product. And because of that radioactivity, and it doesn't only, that's not the only problem with phosphogypsum, but because of the radioactivity in particular, EPA determined in a couple decades ago, in 1991, at the last time they made a ruling on this, was that it had to be stored in stacks. Now, the fact that EPA said we needed to store it in stacks, there's so much of it. The industry was already doing that. It was really just a maintenance of the status quo. But the concern was that the industry would, try to sell this for use in other sort of inappropriate uses for something that's radioactive, like gypsum, like wallboard, or agricultural amendments, which it is used to a certain extent, as so long as the radiation is 10 picocuries per gram or lower. The average amount of Florida fossil gypsum is 35 picograms.
Oh, wow.
Per curie.
So just to make sure I'm keeping up with you and I understand. So for every ton of fertilizer that's created, they create 5 tons of phosphogypsum waste, which is slightly radioactive and cannot be used.
I don't like to say slightly radioactive because that is an industry term. Something's okay. Either radioactive or it's not.
Okay. So it's radioactive.
There's no safe level of radiation. So this is, it's radioactive enough to cause a significant health concern. It's an elevated risk of cancer, particularly lung cancer, because radium degrades into radon gas. And so because of that elevated cancer risk, it needs to be kept in these stacks. It can't be diffused throughout the country.
So when you say a stack, you're talking about a small mountain the size of a landfill or even bigger.
It's much bigger than a typical municipal landfill.
Much bigger than a typical municipal landfill.
So you're talking about a mile wide and several hundred feet tall.
Several hundred feet tall.
Yeah.
Wow. So these are like small mountains of radioactive waste that have popped up all around Florida. It's radioactive, so it needs to just be isolated and placed somewhere for the long haul, right? Yeah. And guess what? We won the lottery. We won all these gyp stacks in Florida. Wonderful.
There are some limited uses that the EPA does allow. And then the Trump administration actually recently approved the use of phosphogypsum in road building, and that's currently being challenged by the Center for Biological Diversity and People for Protecting the Peace River and some other partners, including labor unions that represent construction workers, because they would be exposed to that radioactivity. But yeah, it should not be used for anything, that's right, for sure. And the idea being we're initially requiring them to be put in these mountains was because that would be safer than spreading it throughout the country in these commercial uses.
Over the years, as you mentioned, phosphate mining companies have declared bankruptcy and have left Florida. Mm-hmm. However, they leave behind these gyp stacks, right? So they've made their profits, they've made their money, they declare bankruptcy, and they leave Florida with these huge mountains of, I guess, just very, very toxic or, dangerous waste. And the state of Florida is kind of left to pick up the pieces when these companies decide to, I've made enough money, I'm declaring bankruptcy and I'm out of here. What has happened in the last few years at a couple of these gyp stacks? And tell me where they are. Let's start with the first one. A gyp stack sprung a leak, right? There was a sinkhole that developed below it. And all of the wastewater that was at the top of this gyp stack just was funneled into the aquifer that people use for drinking water and for other things in North Florida. Tell me what happened there and where was it?
Sure. So I believe you're speaking about the 2016 sinkhole in Mulberry, Florida, which is about 30 miles inland from Tampa. That's at the New Wales stack. That's actually the largest stack in Florida. There's 25 of these, by the way, scattered throughout central and a few in North Florida. So, but this happened in Mulberry, and it's actually not the first sinkhole at that site. It's the fourth one, actually, that we know about. One that was reported in 1994, and then two others in 2004 and 2011, which the industry never, or regulators never called a sinkhole. They called them anomalies, but the geologists that we had look at that data said that they had the same effect of a sinkhole. So yeah, this is the fourth that we know about, and that happened in 2016. That released 215 million gallons of radioactive, toxic, heavy metal containing process water, acidic process water, which again is co-generated along with the phosphogypsum during that toxic chemical reaction that creates fertilizer. And it also likely contained a lot of phosphogypsum solids as well. So that plume is still in the aquifer to this day. And Mosaic, the owner of the phosphogypsum stack, is still, you know, attempting to recover that water through its recovery wells at a rate of 4,000 gallons per minute through their wells. But the plume remains, and because there's so little that we know about our complex karst geology, you know, independent studies have shown that although, you know, Mosaic says that plume is contained, remained on site, and it's still on site as long as they keep pumping at that rate, independent studies have shown that we have no idea where that plume went. It's very likely that, you know, a fast moving conduit that moved between two monitoring wells and that, you know, that plume is somewhere in another part of the state. So 215 million gallons is quite a bit. It's actually the same amount that was released in Piney Point into the surface water in Tampa Bay. Wow. So again, yeah, the risk of sinkholes and Florida, that part of Florida, the part where phosphate mines are, is known as Sinkhole Alley. It's a very sinkhole prone part of Florida, and even North Florida as well. There have been sinkholes beneath stacks in North Florida, 2009 at the PCS plant being one of them in White Springs. So yeah, sinkholes are a big risk. They're going to continue to happen, especially as these stacks expand and get larger. So neither DEP, which is the regulating agency in Florida in charge of these stacks, neither the industry or DEP has acknowledged that the stack had anything to do with that sinkhole. They said, you know, it's just happened. It's sort of an act of God, which may very well be the case, right? The stack and the acidic water leaking underneath it, maybe it didn't. You know, I think it might be likely that it had something to do with it, but maybe it didn't. That still means that we shouldn't be building stacks on top of this sinkhole prone area if it's going to happen either way.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the company that owns that gyp stack recently apply to make the gyp stack even bigger in the same exact area?
Glad you brought that up. Yes. So they applied at the end of last year, or 2019, actually, and through a series of, you know, back and forth with with the DEP, a lot of like requests for additional information, much of that using their new geophone technology to sort of measure the seismic activity underneath the stack to make sure that it's, you know, not going to happen again. They went ahead and determined that application was complete in March, publicly noticed it, and then in April, Mosaic discovered an avian, which the hydrogeologist that I know didn't even know what an avian was. It's not typically used by some karst geologists, but he explained it in layman's terms as a collapsed infilled sinkhole that, despite all that new technology, hadn't been discovered yet in this expansion area, meaning that you know, that collapsed sinkhole probably existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's already there, but it shows that land is unstable. It's geologically unstable. So that's the latest with that permit. The draft permit was expected to be issued April 15th. Hasn't, as far as I can tell, been issued yet. But if they do issue that permit, it'll be expanding a stack on demonstrated land that is geologically unstable and very likely to have a sinkhole open up underneath it.
So let's get up to date with what's happening more recently at a gyp stack and talk about Piney Point.
Sure.
From what I understand, Piney Point was one of those gyp stacks that had been left behind by one of these companies that went bankrupt. And the state of Florida kind of inherited this monster pile of toxic waste and has been babysitting it more or less for the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years or so. And now now there's a problem with it. What happened at Piney Point?
Sure. So yeah, to really talk about Piney Point, it has a long sordid history, but we'll start back when Mulberry Phosphates went bankrupt in 2001. And the same regulatory agency, DEP, was in charge back then. And there was, you know, evidence that mold, again, because this is a volatile industry and because mulberry phosphates had just had a major spill in 1997 at another plant where it had to pay some significant fines and was having some financial trouble as a result of that. A lot of people believe that that 1997 spill was the final nail in its in the coffin as far as its financial health was concerned. There were indications for the last several years before that 2001 bankruptcy that mulberry phosphates was going to go bankrupt. They couldn't provide audited financial statements as required by regulations. They couldn't, they had trouble keeping the electric, the lights on, right? And that's important because you need a plant to be constantly running and constant operations in order to keep the that process water volume that's in the pond on top of the stack in order to keep that level manageable so that it doesn't, you know, breach the berms. So that's why these companies remaining solvent while they're operating these stacks is so important, because when you have a sudden abandonment and the operations stop, you're going to have a quick buildup of that process water and someone needs to take in immediately. So nonetheless, despite the fact that there was, you know, every indication that this company was about to go bankrupt, DEP never required mulberry phosphates to close the stack while they still had the money to do so, right? And so they, you know, sort of pretended like they were caught off guard, like, you know, stuck with this, even though it was entirely predictable, and had they followed their own regulations and required the company to close their own stack before they went bankrupt, we wouldn't have had the problem that we had today, which is 20 years later, HRK Holdings, which is a private equity company, not a phosphate mining company, right? Because it's not an active stack anymore and it's not actively producing fertilizer. It's considered a closed stack. They've been managing the stack and using it for dredge deposition, which means that they've been depositing the dredge spoils from Port Manatee's expansion into a closed fossil gypsum stack that was never designed to do that. They've been doing that since about 2010. And that was DEP's idea, right? So DEP transferred responsibility to HRK with that idea in mind. They wanted the site off their hands. They wanted to be able to say, look, this was an environmental disaster, but now there's a beneficial reuse happening. And we're no longer responsible for it. This company is that's gonna, you know, be managing the site for dredge disposal. This was over the objections of the Army Corps of Engineers that said, no way, you can't put dredge material into a stack that's not designed to hold that. That pond on top was only designed to hold liquids, right? DEP lined that pond, called it closed, spent lots of taxpayer money, over $100 million in taxpayer money already to close this stack. So in the news now, you'll hear that DEP is talking about spending $100 million of COVID stimulus money to reclose the stack. Like, it is a reclosure. It's already been done. Point is that DEP really can't be trusted to handle the stack now, considering it has a long history of mismanaging it over the past 20 years.
So to bring our listeners and our viewers up to date, what happened was that back in March of 2021, was it late March, mm-hmm. early April, late
End
March,
of March,
late March 2021, that huge gyp stack, which has a massive lake or pond right at the top of it in the middle, which is lined, but it has a kind of a lake at the top, started leaking. And so that's several hundred feet of elevation above ground level. It starts leaking the water. And so there was a fear that if that leak continued, the dam, that whole stack could collapse and flood the surrounding area, including hundreds of homes, and cause, you know, a lot of property damage, yeah, to privately owned businesses and homes there.
Yeah.
And then not to mention flow in one sheet into Tampa Bay, including many sensitive natural areas around it.
There was large scale evacuations ordered. The jail was evacuated, or I believe they evacuated the inmates only up to the second floor of the jail. But yeah, it was a big risk. A lot of people got text messages saying imminent collapse of Piney Point happening now, leave the area. And so it was very unstable, the entire stack.
And FDEP did move in and start emergency operations to try to prevent that collapse. And how did they prevent that collapse? What did they do, Rachel?
So they authorized the emergency discharge of what ended up being about 215 million gallons of processed water into Tampa Bay. So they pipelined that from into Port Manatee, which is connected to Tampa Bay.
So they basically pumped water out, and that water was pumped into Tampa Bay in order to relieve the pressure at the top of the stack. They pumped 250 million gallons out and let it flow into Tampa Bay. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so up until now, the stack has not collapsed. So a greater catastrophe has been averted, but at the cost of all this polluted water in Tampa Bay.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is not even the first time this exact type of leak has already happened at Piney Point. We had another leak of 170 million gallons, which is almost just as much in 2011 for the exact same reason. And ever since then, you know, that's why HRK is already bankrupt. So this whole idea that we're going to, you know, hold HRK accountable for a problem that's really DEP's making, you know, this is DEP's liner, this is DEP's idea, this is DEP's approval. You know, it's almost to the, it's, and then there, you know, DEP wants, I believe Noah Valenstein was even quoted in a few papers saying, this is a real head scratcher. We need to examine how this happened. What do you mean how this happened? This happened because DEP made this happen. But yeah, to place the blame all on HRK as the owner of the site, is really a way to deflect their own responsibility. This is very much DEP's problem, and DEP's, you know, DEP is culpable here. And it just underscores how inappropriate it would be to expect them to do any better at any of the other 24 stacks scattered throughout the state.
I want to go through just a couple basic questions and end on a kind of a note that's a little bit more forward looking. So we've established that phosphate mining in Florida has strip mined about 500,000 acres in Florida. Much of it has not been reclaimed. There's not much can grow there. Some of it has. Phosphate mining uses tremendous amounts of water. I know this because in my last documentary, The Fellowship of the Springs, we did public records requests for the amount of water that Mosaic uses in their phosphate mining operation. And they have permits to pump as much up to 3 first magnitude springs worth of water out of the ground every day. So up to something like 200 million gallons of water a day that they are permitted to pump. Now, Mosaic says they only use about on average 55 million gallons a day, but that's still almost the first magnitude spring every day. And so so they use a lot of water. They have a huge footprint in terms of where they strip mine, and then they leave behind mountains of phosphogypsum waste in gyp stacks, 25 of which dot the landscape of central and northern Florida. Now, and we've seen the consequences of phosphate mining in most recently in Piney Point, which is an ongoing, I guess, environmental disaster happening in northern Tampa Bay,
right?
Or southern Tampa Bay.
Yeah, to inject that processed water underground now.
Right. So then their solution is to inject that processed water underground, which we really don't know what the consequence of that will be. But now looking forward because we're running a little low on time, but I want to ask you that. No, that's great. This is great. I wish we had more time, but this I want to ask you a couple things. So looking forward, what can be done to reduce the environmental impact of phosphate mining in Florida? Are we talking about trying to expel the industry from Florida and shut it down? Are we talking about them employing certain best management practices that could reduce their use of water and reduce their amount of waste that they produce? Are we talking about better enforcement from the environmental regulators? What can be done moving forward to reduce phosphate mining's environmental impact in Florida?
All of the above, but those are a matter of implementing those goals would be some of those are long-term and some of those are short-term. So for the long-term, yes, I don't believe this industry should exist, right? We do need to transform our food system. We're going to have to, whether we like it or not, because it's a finite resource and we will run out. There's already evidence that we're running out just by the nature of Mosaic moving its drag lines further south to non-contiguous pieces of land. It's very inconvenient to move those 1 million pound drag lines to areas that are not already being mined. And they're doing that because they're running out of ore. So eventually we'll have to transform our food system and not require fertilizer in the way that we're using it now. We'll have to change to our regenerative agriculture, you know, where we rotate crops, where we are concerned with soil health, where we don't apply synthetic fertilizers. And that'll be necessary both because we won't have the resource to do it and also because we need that to fight climate change. So that's the long-term goal. In the meantime, before we get there, because that transformation isn't going to happen overnight, And that's going to require broad scale investment, public investment. But until we get there, we need to better regulate this industry and not at the state level. This is a national problem. There are 25 stacks in Florida. There are 70 stacks total, though, scattered throughout the country.
Wow.
And, you know, there's, you know, Superfund sites in Mississippi. There's shifting stack in Louisiana. This is a federal problem. And it's clearly, even if it were only located in Florida, it's clearly too big of a problem for one state agency to handle, particularly DEP. So the EPA needs to step in and better regulate this industry. We've petitioned the EPA to do just that. Got a response back Friday, actually, where they declined to regulate under the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is unfortunate because that's the only response that we're likely to get anytime soon, just based on the way the statutes are written. But we've also requested that they regulate this as hazardous waste, which it meets all the requirements of hazardous waste because of its radioactivity, because of the toxic heavy metal concentrations, and because of its acidity. But it's because of a industry loophole known as the Bevel Amendment, it's currently exempted from those hazardous waste regulations. So we petitioned EPA to reconsider that, and that's still pending. So EPA needs to step in, and if EPA doesn't, then Congress needs to require them to do so, because its problem is only getting worse. The stacks get bigger every day that a plant is in operation. They're growing as we speak. And as the industry has consolidated, so have the stacks. So it's very politically unlikely that a new stack is going to be built in a new community, right? Who's gonna put up with that or tolerate that? So what the industry is doing is just expanding the stacks that are already there. And that makes these stacks experiments. They're engineering marvels. We've never seen a stack this big. We've never managed one this big. And it's a failing experience. We're seeing what's happening as a result. So the solution is twofold. One is to transform our food system and not require fertilizer use. And the other is, while we're still using fertilizer, to better regulate the waste, because many people don't realize exactly where their fertilizer is coming from. It's not just using fertilizer, that's the problem. It's just producing it is just as harmful as using it. And it starts at the mine and it ends in our waterways with runoff.
Right. Well, we never even touched upon that. All that fertilizer that's used in farms in Florida and agriculture, a lot of that ends up in the aquifer. And that in many cases causes algae blooms in our springs. It harms our drinking water in some cases. So from beginning to end, there's environmental challenges and environmental problems with phosphate mining in Florida. And this has been an eye-opening interview, Rachel. I was a reporter in Florida. I didn't even know about phosphate mining until I was older. I think it's one of those industries that flies under the radar and does a good job at that, and keeping off people's radar completely. Knowing what we know now and these massive environmental and public relations disasters that have occurred in the last few years related to gyp stacks and phosphate mining, I think it's important for people to know what's happening in their backyard with phosphate mining. And I think like any industry out there, there's always improvements that can be made. And there's people who work in these industries that are conscientious and that want to do the right thing. And I'm hoping that through this podcast to trigger that kind of sentiment in people, whether they're working for industries or they're just listeners out there, to work together with people to improve any sort of harmful activity that is happening in Florida. Because let's face it, I mean, it's not just beautiful springs and beaches out there. There's a lot of industry out there that is very reluctant to change in any way. But I think that it's inevitable that they change in order to become better corporate citizens and better environmental stewards here in Florida.
I do hope that local decision makers realize that there is no one no one above them that is going to save them when you permit a mine at the local level, so particularly at the county level. DEP is not going to come in and save the day. Look at DEP's track record. The federal government is not going to come in either. It's really, really imperative that we stop this at the mining level. And the best way to do that is for local county commissioners to vote no when the opportunity comes. And I'm particularly speaking about some new mines in DeSoto County in Florida's heartland. So So again, yeah, the best way to stop this is to stop it from even being mined in the first place.
On that note, Rachel, a wonderful environmental lawyer here in Florida and somebody who's doing really, really interesting work. And thank you, Rachel, for joining me today for the Nature of Florida podcast.
Thanks for having me, Oscar.
This episode of the Nature of Florida podcast was brought to you in part by the Felburn Foundation, the Fish and Wildlife Foundation of Florida, and Explica Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to subscribe on our website, The Nature of Florida with Oscar Corral.buzzsprout.com. That's The Nature of Florida with Oscar Corral.buzzsprout.com. Or find us on your favorite platform and follow us on Facebook and Instagram.